Our second case for this morning is United States against Terrence Jones. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court. Stephen Baker on behalf of the United States, the appellant. Because a rational jury could convict the defendant in this case, as the jury below did, the district court's judgment of acquittal should be reversed. The district court did not view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government in this case.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I have a really important preliminary question for you, which is whether, in your view, which you did not do in your brief, we need to evaluate counts 13 and 15 separately.
In our view, Your Honor, we do not. The judge...
It seems to me, if you look at count 15, which is the substantive count, right? 13 is the communications facility.
Yes, Your Honor.
You are reading an enormous amount into do what you doing for Sonny for me and weeped us. I think that's your whole case, and it's really... Wow, it's very ambiguous.
Taken alone, Your Honor, those two phrases are I will grant the court, ambiguous.
But I don't know what buttresses them, frankly. I mean, these guys are hanging out together, but we know that that doesn't tell you anything much. We don't even know what weeped means.
Judge, we don't know what the verb weeped means, but in the context...
In this context, anyway, I suppose we would all have an Oxford English Dictionary definition of it.
Your Honor, I don't think there's a dictionary definition that would help either side in this case. If there were, we would have cited it.
And why didn't you put a... I mean, you guys put drug lingo experts on the stand all the time. You had Johnson there. You could have put people involved who were cooperating in this very arrangement. There's just nothing. Do what you doing for Sonny for me.
Judge,
I mean, what's Sonny doing? Mowing his lawn every day? I mean, you know, I don't know.
No, Judge, and the only way we do know is in the context of the way these parties had a relationship that day.
We don't even know who Sonny is, do we?
No, Judge, we do not.
And so we don't have any idea whether Sonny even lives in Chicago or, you know, we don't know anything about it.
But, Your Honor, you can't take that phone call by itself. That's the initiation phone call between Dominic Fenley and the defendant in this case. That's the 2 p.m. phone call.
Right. And so I've gone through this timeline very carefully, and there are not many things that associate Jones with what went on. Jones gets into Finley's car a couple times. There's this period of the ever-shrinking period of time that you first said was 90 minutes in the Christiana Street house, and now it's shrunk to an hour. And actually, it looks like it's probably not even an hour because we've got phone calls that seem to indicate that Jones is driving around looking for somebody. It's very unclear to me how long he was in the house. There's no evidence of how long it takes to cook crack. There's no evidence that this crack is associated with the powder that he had, his brick. There's no way perhaps he went to some other place while he wasn't under surveillance, and there was darn near an hour of that time. It's at best, a thin case, and the question is it so thin that the district court was correct?
And it wasn't, Judge. The court has the chronology correct. There were several things throughout the day, though, that indicate that these two individuals were working together to cook that crack cocaine.
But where's... And by the way, let me ask you this. Are you... Your whole theory of this case is that Jones cooks it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You aren't trying to say he helped the conspiracy in any other way.
We do, in the alternative, make the aiding and abetting argument,
That's
Your
just
Honor.
It,
but the theory of the case
what?
Presented
yeah.
was that he cooked the crack cocaine. Yes, Your Honor.
And boy, I see... Nothing. There's no evidence from inside the house. that any cooking was going on there. I've pointed out that there's a whole hour that Finley could have gotten that amount. It's about 3 ounces, right, of crack from anywhere. For all I know, the house was a stash house, and there was already cooked and ready to be distributed cocaine sitting in it.
Judge, those are inferences that could be drawn from the information, some of it reasonable, but in cases where, as the jury here had reasonable inferences that which could differ, competing inferences should be cited by reviewing courts in favor of a jury's verdict.
But where is the... What concrete piece of evidence do you have that anything was cooked in the house?
Before he went into the house, Judge, and this is a 5-hour time period which the court is aware, you've reviewed all the calls. Before he went into the house, Finley had powder cocaine. He needed it cooked into crack. That's clear from his activity that day. It's clear from his conversations with the defendant, but in addition to that, there's the conversations with Frederick Taylor, which are then recorded by the consensual source, indicating he had the powder cocaine at about 2:30 that afternoon, an entire kilogram of it. There's the testimony of Clarence Johnson, the separate person who'd also cooked crack cocaine for Finley in the past, but refused to do that this day. So it was clear that that's what Finley was trying to do. And there are the phone calls with the defendant in this case, Your Honor. The defendant in this case talks to Finley repeatedly about getting something. You mentioned...
And we have no idea.
It's obviously very suspicious. I think we all can agree with that. And the problem I have here is kind of in the rhetorical dueling in the briefs, you all emphasize defer to the jury, and the defense properly reminds us, and the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that association and presence are not enough, and it's hard to see much more here.
But there is more, Judge. Mm-hmm. There are 11 separate calls between these individuals as they're going through this day.
Look at the calls. I mean, the one you were just talking about, where they keep talking about, can you get M at Walgreens or CVS, or you can get it at Walmart. I don't know what they're talking about. Are they talking about this blender or this little mixer? Are they talking
about... veterinary medicine?
The deworming medicine that... On extra record information, I understand, would be extraordinarily unhealthy for somebody to ingest.
And Your Honor, the point that the court makes about those calls being suspicious, by themselves, are they enough? No, they are not. But what else was happening this day? What else was the defendant doing?
But why are you relying on evidence that they buy something completely unidentified? I mean, we're not allowed to put people in prison on the basis of speculation.
And, Your Honor, we're not relying on the evidence that the defendant or Dominic Finley actually bought anything. We are relying on the conversations, let me be clear, Judge, which were suspicious, indicating there was a need for something to cook crack cocaine. And then the behavior of the defendant...
Well, look, I don't disagree at all. If it were against federal law to want to be in the cocaine business, these guys have clearly violated it. Jones, Finley, everybody else. I don't think they're saints at all. But what I do have a lot of concern with is whether you met your burden of proof in this case.
And Judge, let's look at some of the other information, some of the other evidence that was put before the jury that helped us meet that burden. In addition to the phone calls, the defendant took the travel with Finley in his car and then was subject to the police stop. Finley was driving. He cuts into an alley driving up onto a sidewalk.
The defendant stands right there by the car and lets the police come arrest him. It's Finley who flees.
Yes, Your Honor, he did. Finley also tossed the crack cocaine out the window with the defendant in the passenger seat. That crack cocaine was the crack cocaine recovered in the case. The defendant was present for that. He then, within
right,
that
and that,
hour,
that's the crack cocaine that doesn't account for the other 914 grams of the kilo.
That's right, Judge. But in the additional information that was put before the jury, Clarence Johnson, who testified that he cooked for Finley on other occasions, said that Finley always took 63 grams, so just a little over 2 ounces, 2 1/4 ounces, and tried to cook it into the 3 ounces that Your Honor cited. So that was consistent with Finley's behavior within his prior drug activity.
That's the problem, though, I think, that the government did a good job of establishing what Finley did, that Finley intended to distribute drugs that day. But why does all that evidence that supports what Finley did provide an appropriate factual context for any of the defendant's behavior?
In addition to that behavior of what Finley was doing that evening, Your Honor, the defendant went back to that very alley to look for the crack cocaine, and that's the conversation that the court referred to a bit ago. the weep dust conversation. Now, weeped, I don't know what it means, and we didn't have any expert, and we didn't have any co-conspirator that could tell us what it means. What's clear from that conversation and what the jury heard was that the defendant was talking about us. He's in that alley for one purpose, and that's to look for the crack cocaine he saw tossed from Finley's door. He personally was wronged by that. That's what's implied by that conversation. That's what's clear from it. Whatever that verb means, he's talking about someone else stealing the crack cocaine that belonged not to Finley, you, but Finley and the defendant, us. And that's when he took ownership for the purpose of the phone calls and the activity of that day. And that's what the jury was relying on reasonably to interpret the remainder of the evidence that was put before it.
From that effort to recover the crack, I understand you'd have a pretty good theory for saying he was aiding and abetting the attempted possession. But that's not the way the case was tried, not the way it was argued or anything else. When, under your theory, when was Jones in possession, actual or constructive, of crack cocaine?
Between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock when he cooked it, Judge. When he was looking for in the house. Whether it was in 1447 South Christiana or elsewhere, that's what he's talking about in those phone calls.
But we don't even know if the cocaine was in the house, right?
We don't, Judge. But we don't need to establish where it was when he was cooking it. And we don't ask the court to understand that.
He cooked it, though. As I said, there's an hour that Pacino doesn't have him under surveillance, during which Finley, given his apparent connections, it seems to me, could have found 86 grams of crack cocaine in any number of places. They're driving all over the west side of Chicago, from Kedzie and, you know, south of Roosevelt Road all the way up to, you know, almost to Armitage.
Yes, Your
Honor. To Austin. I mean, they're all over the place.
They are, Judge, but where they are together.
We need to nail down that there's something going on about cocaine in the Christiana house.
Judge, what we need to nail down is something's going on with the cocaine with the defendant.
No, you said your theory was cooking, and that if it was cooked anywhere, it was cooked in the Christiana house.
That's where the defendant left when he got into the car that the cocaine was dumped out of. Yes, Judge. He could have cooked it. He said his cousin's place was right around the corner. He could have cooked it there and then met Finley at that house as well.
But we have no evidence of that. I mean, just because we all think that such things could happen, and I'm not saying they couldn't have, but normally we have to prove things in criminal cases.
Yes, Your Honor, and we did here. There were reasonable inferences that support that evidence that he was in that house. He was seen in the area going towards it, the calls leading up to it, and the continuing calls between the defendant and Finley about their needs for the activity that are going on, which the court admits were suspicious.
But he was in all sorts of houses. You're avoiding the fact that you don't prove that that cocaine-related activities are happening in that house or any other house.
Your Honor, we don't need to prove that it happens in that house. We need to prove that it happens with this defendant. Now, that house is where...
It's a little bit of time to do the cooking.
That's true,
you need
Judge.
Some equipment, you need heat, you need, you know, ingredients.
That's true, Judge, but that a description of what was needed was given by Clarence Johnson in the case. What he did
but
in order...
I'm saying he couldn't have done it out in the middle of Garfield Park. I mean, he has to have been in some place...
But really, Judge, all he needs is a heat source and a pot. That's really what Clarence Johnson identified. He was attempting to get additional things, which the court admits were suspicious, in order to aid in making that enterprise more profitable, stretching that cocaine. But really what he needs is water, sodium bicarbonate or baking soda, and a pot and the cocaine.
Unfortunately, we all actually know that. I wish we didn't.
This court's all too familiar with the process, I imagine.
Moving away from the activities that the government believes occurred in the house, what about the car? I mean, why didn't the government advance more aggressively the aiding and abetting theory or the constructive possession theory of the events that occurred in the car, where the only two people at the time that the crack cocaine was thrown out of the car were Finley and the defendant, and then viewed in the light of the defendant's actions afterward? Why wasn't that a theory that was advanced more strenuously?
At the strategic time of trial, Judge, that was not what we were pushing.
Well, you asked that the instruction on aiding and abetting be given to the jury, and they had the benefit of that.
That's right, Judge. And in clarifying the case for the presentation of the jury, one of the things we did was lean heavily on the evidence that we had. The court brings out an alternative inference of what was going on, and a good one in terms of the law. When competing inferences are available, however, that can support a guilty jury verdict as we advance this one now, that jury verdict should stand, but we did not at trial.
You think we should affirm on a theory that was never argued to the jury?
I think that this court, if the theory would support a jury verdict...
Or rather, affirm the verdict, I guess. So.
I understand, Your Honor. I think the court should affirm a guilty or a jury verdict where there is a theory of liability that is supported under the law that was given to the jury at the time that they were considering the case. The court is very correct that that was not the emphasis of our presentation at the jury court level or here to this court.
Well, is it even an appropriate analysis then that the government perhaps forfeited the argument because they failed to raise it at the post-conviction hearings? Because of the standard of review now, is that even something that we need to concern ourselves with?
I don't believe so, Judge, because forfeiture would require a much more active intention.
Forfeiture requires a blank mind. Waiver, of course.
Exactly, Judge. But we did propose the instruction along those lines. In the same concentration we made before the jury, we made that concentration of the evidence before the district court.
Right. The government always asks for the aiding and abetting instruction and always gets it, at least in my experience. But if it's not argued, either to the jury or to the district judge after the trial, I have a little trouble seeing why.
And Judge, I think in that case, the standard for forfeiture is the reason that this court should still consider it. If there were plain error on the part of the district court judge, and here we would argue that there is discarding a jury verdict in favor of acquittal where there is a reasonable theory of liability that supports conviction, then that
advanced by the government at trial.
Even so, Judge, because plain error would be the standard under forfeiture. Your Honor, as I see I'm out of time, I'll reserve what I have.
Okay. I will probably give you another minute because we asked you questions, but you, in fact, used it up. So, Ms. Amdur.
May it please the Court, my name is Linda Amdur. I represent Terrence Jones.
Well, why don't we start where we left off with this end-of-the-day event when the cocaine gets tossed out and Mr. Jones goes back to the alley to look for it. He uses this inclusive word, you know, maybe at a high cost, two little letters, us, weeped us. And so the first question is whether that's enough to retrospectively shed light on everything else that happened that day to sustain the jury's verdict on the theory the government did argue that Jones was the cooker that day for Mr. Finley, or whether we should go down this forfeiture plain error route that was the last thing we were talking about.
Well, our position as to the conversation in the alley is simply if we go back and we look at that entire conversation, first of all, when Jones said he weeped us, it appears in that conversation the Finleys' understanding of what Jones has said is simply that they saw us, that they peeped us. Also, I think the court really needs to take into consideration other things that happened in the alley at the time that Jones returned there. It was Eric Olison's testimony, who was the witness that testified about this, that the reason that Jones was asked to accompany him was because Jones had been in the car at the time that the bag was thrown
right,
from
Olison
the car.
Olison complains that he doesn't, maybe it's a big alley, I don't know, but he
doesn't know
exactly where to focus.
Correct. At the same time, Olison acknowledged that Finley never told him that Jones had cooked cocaine that day, that Jones was riding with him in the car for the purposes of distributing it, and that Jones even knew what was in the bag at the time that it was discarded from the car.
What about Jones' description of what they were looking for, the large white bag?
That's what we found as a real stumbling block in the government's presentation on this subject. It's throughout the government's case that the recovered crack cocaine was in a plastic bag. That's from the recovering officer, the FBI agent that took it to the lab. However, Jones repeatedly says that he's looking for, he calls it a big-ass white bag.
But wouldn't it look white? I mean, if it's like a zip bag or any kind of bag, that's transparent, but it's got a lot of white stuff in it. Wouldn't it generally appear to be
white?
Well,
the point is, though, that if Jones prepared this and personally put it in a plastic bag, he certainly would then say that he was looking for a plastic bag. Although it could be perceived differently by somebody else, I think Jones would know what kind of bag that he put it in.
Well, isn't the standard, though, that's a reasonable inference that weighs in favor of supporting the jury's inference on that, that we have to view it in the light most favorable to the government, and so it's reasonable that they could have interpreted that it was a clear bag, but it contained a white substance.
And when you're walking through an alley looking for something, I mean, maybe some other people don't look by color, maybe they look by shape, but it's going to look from a distance the color of whatever's in the bag. You're not going to see a plastic bag. I'm not sure that that's your strongest.
Well, I do think, though, in terms of the words themselves, that would not meet a standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that when Jones said they weeped us, which is the government's argument in this, that somehow that meant that for that particular bag, that Jones had a personal interest in it, that
so
it was
what,
his, that he had cooked it.
Is it your position? I mean, listen, the tapes do make it sound like it's weeped, not peeped. I mean, those aren't letters that are too much the same. But was the government required to introduce, you know, drug lingo testimony or something to let us know what this word weeped actually means?
Well, I think that if the government is taking the position that weeped means something other than peeped, which is what I understood Finley to understand it to mean, then they would have an obligation to explain why they are saying it means stole or to steal. They, as you indicated earlier, the government called two cooperating witnesses that were very familiar with the world of drugs and narcotics, and they also called the expert who did tell the jury what certain words meant, such as connect and raw and brick and some of that language. If weeped had a particular meaning within this world, then within the narcotics milieu, then obviously that person should have testified to what weep meant. I think it's fair in considering the language to think that these people were not prepared to say, not the expert, not the two government witnesses, that weeped was a word that meant stole.
But isn't that plucking a little portion of the evidence out of context of what really happened, and that's that the defendant was in a car in which cocaine was discarded from, and then it's apparent from the calls, at least it's a reasonable inference from the calls, including that statement, weep, that he went back and was attempting to find a big white bag, being the cocaine that was thrown out.
Well, he was asked to go back by Olison because he knew where it had been pitched or discarded. The evidence in this case is not that when he was going back that it was his idea to go back.
I think the point is that taking all of this, it seems indisputable that, first of all, Jones is in the car with Finley. The bag of cocaine is in the car with them as they're driving down the alley. Finley tosses it out of the car, and then later on, you know, Jones, no matter why, you know, it's somebody's request or whatever, comes back to retrieve it. So that all takes me back to the other point I wanted you to focus on a bit. I am perfectly willing to believe that that scenario tells us exactly nothing about whether Jones cooked that cocaine or not. But does it tell us something about whether he was aiding and abetting Finley's distribution operation? And if it does, then what do we do with the trial record? There is an instruction on that, at least.
Well, it's our position that the government has waived that argument in front of this court.
Well, where did they stand up and say, we are forswearing the aiding and abetting?
They did not do that, but they drenched this record with the idea that Jones cooked that cocaine in the apartment. And that's why, if you notice in the district court's opinion. Of course she never goes off and starts talking about aiding and abetting. All she heard was a very forceful argument that Jones cooked the cocaine in the apartment at Christiana. That's all that was ever argued or came close to.
So you think it's unfair to say the district judge was wrong because the government never advanced this theory. But on the other hand, you know, in the law, if somebody has, in fact, violated the law and there's a conviction, it's a momentous thing to turn that conviction over.
I think, again, though, it's significant that Finley never told Oleson that Jones had cooked it or that Jones was helping him deliver it.
You're exactly right. There's no direct evidence that he cooked it. Finley never says so. No one else says so. So we can start with that. The government thinks there's circumstantial evidence of the cooking.
Well, there's also as related to what's going on in the alley and what happened in the car, there is this fact that Finley immediately flees. It's Finley that throws it from the car and flees. Jones just stands there. He never runs. He waits until police come because the car's been crashed, so he's going to have to stay there. And he stands. He doesn't.
Maybe Jones is a realist.
Yeah.
Or he's slower than Finley is.
Well, I think that flight, certainly in Finley's case, could be consciousness of guilt, but I don't know that the converse is necessarily true in support of your argument that staying put at in a vehicle in which crack cocaine was just tossed out of, which I think the record shows that he knew about, means that he's somehow unaware of what's happening.
Well, I don't think that the record shows that he was part of the delivery of the cocaine or that he was ever in possession or constructive possession of that cocaine. There is no evidence of that. And that was never argued by the government. That argument was never made. And I don't think that argument is really being made here, that he somehow was aiding and abetting Finley in delivering it. Another thing that should be called to this court's attention is that there, when they leave the apartment, they leave at 6:30, at 6:20.
The Christiana Street place? Yeah.
Christiana. There is a call that Finley has with Oleson. And in that call, he is making arrangements to go meet Oleson at a place they call the P, which Oleson testified to meant the park. Oleson had been out collecting a debt for Finley. He's telling him he's getting the money, and they say, okay, we'll meet at the P. So the whole idea that they're going out to deliver cocaine, or I should say that Finley is going out to deliver cocaine, is not in the government's evidence in the case. Finley should be en route to go meet Oleson for their scheduled meeting at which Finley will obtain the results of Oleson obtaining drug debt for him. I mean, this casts light on what would Jones have known, assuming he didn't cook the cocaine. What was Jones' intention in riding in the car with Finley? And the call that immediately precedes the exit from the Christian apartment and the driving on the west side is a call about Finley meeting with Oleson and collecting a drug debt. That's call 5949.
Okay.
Your Honor, wrap this up, we believe that the call at 2 p.m. does about Sonny.
The Sonny call?
The
yeah.
Sonny call, right. That it's unreasonable to assume that call is about crack cocaine.
I can't figure out what that call's about at all because since I don't know who Sonny is, I don't know what Sonny was doing for him. And without knowing that, it's hard to say that it's cooking crack or whether it's something else.
Well, our added point is, and this is the thrust of the government's argument in the brief, that the remaining evidence confirms or shows this court that what they were talking about was cooking cocaine. It's simply our point that that is not so, that the evidence, there is not evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that they cooked the cocaine in the apartment. Added to that, Your Honor, the jury would have had to have assumed that there was no way that Finley could have obtained that crack in the afternoon when he was driving around Chicago. They were going to have to assume that when he was unsurveilled, he didn't obtain the 89 grams of crack.
Was the brick ever found? The brick of cocaine that Finley started out with?
No, there wasn't. It wasn't. Now, the car was not searched at the time. It crashed because there was an ongoing investigation, and the authorities did not want to search the car at that time.
Odd.
But continuing with this, the jury would also have to assume that when Finley met with the man, I think it's 5949 West Huron, that at that particular time, there was a man in front of the house. Jones was not there. Finley had the meeting. The man was carrying a bag. The jury would also have to assume that when Finley met with his girlfriend, when she came to the apartment, I think around 5:30 in the afternoon, they would have to assume that she did not bring the crack cocaine. The jury would have to assume that when the woman who came later to the apartment went up to the entrance, was there a little bit, and then went back to her car, that she did not provide this bag of cocaine. I mean, there is really no evidence that crack cocaine was cooked in the apartment. So the jury would have to have made those assumptions. And it's simply our position that when you combine the things, the call at the drugstore, which we have tried to point out to the court, if that call is really examined, it appears that they're talking about something else. I mean, Finley was going to meet with his girlfriend that afternoon, and it looks as though what he wanted was a personal item from the drugstore. He even gets angry when Jones said to him that he's going to pick it up. Why would he become enraged and say, get off the phone, I'm getting this myself? I only asked a question of what drugstore to go to. Well,
what about the parts in the conversation in which Jones seems to be reminding Finley about the money? Why is your mind needs to get back, and I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something about, you know, aren't you thinking about the money?
Right.
And the MOB comment. I mean, doesn't that provide some context to these calls?
I don't think that. First of all, that is something that's set much later in time at a different point in the case. But I don't believe that a rational jury could find Jones guilty based on that conversation alone or the peep does conversation.
But what about collectively put in the proper context and looking at the series of events as a whole and not parsing them out and looking at each one independently to see if each fact can stand alone?
Well, of course, it's our position the judge didn't parse things out. She really evaluated what the evidence was in the case. But I think the government's argument here is, as we would say, somewhat circular in this, because they're saying, well, you know, they were on the business of making crack cocaine because they talked about that at 2 o'clock. And then when they get to the end of it and they bring out these other things that happened at the very end, they're saying, oh, but the fact that we had the weepdus peepdus call means that they were talking about crack cocaine. I don't think that is really the evidence that is presented in the case, that this shows beyond a reasonable doubt, which a rational jury had to find, that Jones did cook crack cocaine or that he was involved or assisted Finley in doing that.
All right. Thank you very much. I will give you one more minute, Mr. Baker. Your time has expired, but we ask questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the defendant's conclusion, the point was that there's a circular argument to what the government is saying. That is not true. What the government is saying is that given all the information that the court is familiar with from this case that was admitted into evidence, it was reasonable for the jury to infer that exactly what the defendant was doing was aiding Finley in cooking the crack cocaine. He had the powder cocaine. He cooked it. He gave it back to Finley. They left that house in order to deliver it. One specific thing noted by the defense was the phone call with Eric Ollison at 6:30 p.m. when Finley says, "I'm coming your way. I'll meet you by the P." The defendant advanced the fact that that might have been a call. What Eric Ollison said was that I'd collected money. I was going to give it to Finley. In addition, Eric Ollison testified, and this is in his testimony before the jury, that what his role in Finley's organization was, he held on to his crack cocaine and distributed it as Finley instructed him. Finley doesn't have to tell him on that call, "I have 86.8
grams." What if Ollison had it, though? They meet. I mean, I'm curious that you never find what's left of the kilo of powder. Because your assumption, which, as far as I know, has a zero evidentiary basis, is that the 86 grams were cooked from the powder that Finley starts out the day with.
That is our assumption, Judge.
Why do we assume that? Why not? It's not like it's the only cocaine in Chicago.
No, Your Honor, it's not. I think it's a reasonable inference for the jury to have drawn on the basis of the evidence presented. Because Finley had this powder cocaine, he needed it weighed, and he was looking to get it cooked that day. He ended up with 86.8 grams. I will correct one issue. The car, I believe, though this is not, the car was searched pursuant to the stop, but there was no kilo there found or ever found in the course of the investigation. You're correct about that.
Was there another passenger in the car at the time of the stop?
No, Your Honor. It was just the defendant and Dominic Finley.
She'd gotten out earlier.
She had, Judge, and the jury was shown a map of the area. Okay. She got out about a block and a half from the 1447 house.
Okay, thanks.
For those reasons, Judge, the government believes that this court should reverse and remand for sentencing in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Ms. Amger?
Yes.
We appreciate very much your efforts on behalf of your client. Thanks to the government as well.